exponential tech is really powerful. It's like the power of gods, at least little gods, but we don't have the kind of wisdom, love, and prudence to use that power well. And you don't get to keep doing exponential warfare and exponential externalities on a finite planet and not blow yourself up.
Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. In this episode, I talk to social philosopher Daniel Schmachtenberger about exponential technology and its effects on our current world. According to Daniel, organizations that harness the power of modern tech rarely use it for good, like how social media companies boost polarizing content to maximize user engagement, leading to a distrust of science and destabilized democracies. To overcome humanity's current existential threat, Daniel argues we all need to work towards a radical cultural enlightenment. We also touch on the topics of collective intelligence, human development, power, responsibility, and civilization. It's always great chatting with Daniel. He's a good friend and very thoughtful human being. So without further ado, I bring you Daniel Schmachtenberger. Hey, Daniel, I can't wait to talk to you today on the Psychology Podcast.
I'm so happy to be talking to you again, Scott. It's been a while.
It has been a while. I love the beard. I love the beard.
Thank you. You've got a couple months to catch up.
I do have a couple months, but you look very wise, and that will catch up with the fact you are wise. You know, you are a very wise human. As long as I've known you, I've been really impressed by your insights and your almost clairvoyance about the future of civilization, which is pretty cool. Did you always have that kind of being able to think not short term, but very, very long term about the arc of humanity?
I think it's worth noting that I'm profoundly less good at that than I wish I was, and also profoundly less good at it than I thought I was when I was younger.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
It's an important thing to comment on. But yeah, I was fortunate. I was homeschooled growing up and got to have a pretty unique curriculum, largely self-guided curriculum, but the things my parents were into, so I was exposed. One of them was Bucky Fuller. And so comprehensive anticipatory design science, thinking through long arc of history, long arc of future, and how we design with that in mind was kind of early background. And then a lot of Fritjof Capra and system science that was also doing kind of long-term forecasting and deep history. So I would say long time scale has been with me most of my life.
Well, it's really allowed you to see and point out a lot of things going on in our world today that could be greatly, greatly improved. There's a lot that could be improved. So let's take some slice of some of the things that have been on your mind lately. I know one big thing is technology and the impact of technology on our psychology and the risk of technology. But I am wondering to what extent you see the problem as, do you see it as an extremely as bad as, you know, people are panicking, you know, there's a whole tech panic. Where are you in the spectrum from that to it is completely fundamentally turning kids into robots and causing them to be addicted and suicide rates, et cetera, versus the other continuum? There's a new book that just came out by Robbie Suave. I don't know if you heard about it. I think it's actually called Tech Panic, where he says, everybody calm down. There's really nothing to worry here. All the liberals are panicking for nothing. Where do you kind of fall in this large, broad spectrum?
Yeah, there are naive techno-optimist and naive techno-pessimist views. The naive techno-pessimist view sees the problems that are associated with tech and takes a Luddite direction. And that approach will always just lose because it will have less power than whatever group is embracing the tech, which has the power. So really, there are no futures that have any chance that aren't higher tech, because even if they were better, they would just lose. And so from a real politic assessment, specifically now, exponential tech is so much more powerful than every other form of legacy power that only the groups that are developing and deploying exponential tech will have any say in the future.
Wait, can you actually define what exponential tech is?
There's a number of different ways we could define it. Tech that has exponentially more influence or power or exponentially less people need to be involved, exponentially less resource, time scale. So formally, exponential tech would mean technology that recursively makes itself better. So if you think about computation, I can use a computer to simulate how to make a better computer chip, get better transistor density, and then that better computer chip can do better simulations to make a better computer chip. I can use AI to make better AI. But not just formally that. There are kinds of tech that help advance a world system where that world system as a whole makes better tech, right? Nukes don't necessarily make better nukes, but they definitely concentrate power to where the groups that have them can do more tech investment, including in nukes. So I wouldn't call it an exponential tech formally in terms of self-recursion, but so there's a range of definitions. If we mostly we're talking about, when we say exponential tech, we're talking about computation and its derivatives that do recursively affect themselves. But you also have things like you have a product for sale, a good or service that doesn't have atoms involved. So there's no unit cost. So I make the thing once and then sell it an indefinite number of times with no, you know, so it's all margin. So I get an exponential return on capital. As a result, this is why pretty much all the unicorns are software companies, and all of the capital flows into software, which is from hardware, or so much of it has, which is why Silicon Valley has been largely software. But exponential tech also means, if you look at the time scale that it took for Facebook to reach a billion people compared to, say, anything else historically, the first oil company or whatever. So the speed to scale, or that Facebook has 3 billion users on a monthly basis. So the total scale, or the amount of scale, those social media companies have AI models of you that predict your behavior better than intelligence companies have on their own populations. Yeah. Also, it takes way less people to run one of those companies or that technology. And so by exponential tech, we mean all of the, roughly all of those things, where there is some kinds of either the return on capital, the tech making the tech better, basically increased scale of impact from smaller groups in shorter periods of time.
Okay, cool. So yeah, so where do you see that?
So the center of that is computation. The very center of that is AI. And then computation and AI working on computational substrate, like how to make quantum computers and photic computers and better GPUs and all like that is the next step. Then all the sensors that go into it, the whole Internet of Things world and the AR, VR kind of extensions. Then computation and AI applied to nanotech, biotech, protein folding, the rest of the world, right? So that's kind of the way of thinking about it. I would say that exponential tech provides so much more power than everything else that it just wins via economic warfare, political information warfare, whatever you want to call it, competitive dynamics. And so if there's a group that has got a vision for how to make a better future, but it doesn't have the power to enact it, it's not going to matter. And the power to enact it is going to come through the size of the lever that is affecting the choices, which is going to be the tech. And so right now, I would say there are only a few types of groups that are really developing and deploying exponential tech, which means they are the types of groups that have the most influence on shaping the future currently. And none of them are thinking about the types of things that matter for the types of future we want adequately.
Okay, let's pause there. You're saying so much that is rich. Now, I assume Facebook is one of those that you are referring to. And do you think they have been rightly criticized along those lines for not fully realizing their potential that they could have or the kind of power they could have?
Totally.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't answer your initial question. I started to go off in another direction around the techno-optimist or techno-pessimist direction. Nobody wants to go back to a pre-technology time where Novocaine didn't exist and you still need dental work, right? Like there's lots of things about tech that we like, but all the tech also corresponds with externalities of harms across environmental supply chains or social dynamics or whatever it is. So is the world getting better from tech like Pinker and Rosling and people would say, or is it getting worse like so many environmentalists and Center for Humane Technology and other places would say? It's getting better and worse at the same time on different metrics.
That's the most nuanced answer I've ever heard in the history of answers. I love that. Yeah.
It's getting better associated with the metrics that we're measuring and optimizing for, and particularly that have capital associated, and it's getting worse on all the other metrics. It's getting worse on heaps of psychological metrics related to this podcast, where we were just talking earlier that there are so many psychiatric disorders that where people don't have a full-blown diagnosable version of it. They have a subclinical version of generalized anxiety disorder or of borderline type dynamics or of addictive tendencies or of existential angst and nihilism or but like ubiquitous psychopathology is one of the externalities of all of our tech and success.
But do you mean it? Do you mean it? Is it a consequence, or is it? There's obviously a bidirectional loop there, right?
There is a bidirectional loop. The drug dealer says, hey, I'm just supplying a thing that the people want. But when they offer the first hit for free to get the people to want it, starting when their kids are in bad environments where they, you know, don't really understand the full consequence, and then offer it to people who are already addicted, there is a there's a supply side responsibility missing, especially given the asymmetric capacity of the supply side relative to the demand side, that then gets to have this plausible deniability called, I'm just supplying the existing demand, but it's manufacturing demand that is not actually healthy and that is manufacturable because of the asymmetry of supply. So once companies start getting big enough to make people want shit that they never had before, in fact, make them feel unhappy if they don't have the shit that they never had before, make design and obsolescence and style changes that make them continue to need the new shit, and then say, look, we're just giving the people what they want. There's something basically, rather than authentic demand for real things driving supply of real value, you start to have supply wanting to continue to concentrate its power, driving demand to then be able to have the plausible deniability of saying it's all voluntary. But it's appealing to the lower angels of our nature rather than the higher angels of our nature. And when you start to get such radical asymmetries as multi-billion dollar or trillion dollar companies that are coordinated, and the demand side is not coordinated. There aren't like labor unions of all of demand that go up against Google that are also using the same kind of AIs. It's the individual Google user against Google, and Google's using the most advanced AIs in the world with like $1 trillion market cap against an individual person who doesn't even know that their data is being harvested to optimize their behavior to sell to somebody. Then the whole idea of market and the rationality of the market is very broken. And so then if you want to maximize the lifetime revenue of a customer, addiction is a great way to maximize lifetime revenue of a customer. And then sure. If you're something like Facebook or Google, where you're an advertiser, where maximizing addiction across every different avenue possible, right? I get to, like, I'm make money by maximizing their attention. And so then I can sell their behavior to all of the different industries. That's kind of a meta play on addiction.
Hey, this is so rich. So let's take a pause here a second. Hey everyone, I'm excited to announce that the 8-week online Transcend course is back. Become certified in learning the latest science of human potential and learn how to live a more fulfilling, meaningful, creative, and self-actualized life. The course starts March 13th of this year and goes until May 1st. The course includes more than 10 hours of recorded lectures, 4 live group Q&A sessions with me, 4 small group sessions with our world-class faculty, a plethora of resources and articles to support your learning, and an exclusive workbook of growth challenges that we think will help you overcome your deepest fears and grow as a whole person. There are even some personalized self-actualization coaching spots with me available as an add-on. Save your spot today by going to transcendcourse.com. That's transcendcourse.com. We have so much fun in this course, and I look forward to welcoming you to be a part of the Transcender community. Okay, now back to the show. Let's elucidate or delineate exactly what we mean by the lower angels and what we mean by the higher angels. I think that would be useful in this conversation. Now, my head immediately starts to go to, when you say lower angels, I think ego. I think self-esteem drive. You know, I think of it from a Maslow perspective, right? I think about what needs are being met. When I think lower, I think basic needs versus higher needs, which are more growth-oriented needs. And I just wanted to see if you're on the same page. Are we thinking along similar lines here?
I'll say it a different way. Okay, so if I'm looking at what is fast food as a phenomena? What is Hostess and McDonald's as a phenomena? Because it's providing base level needs, survival needs in the same way that food from your garden would provide them. So it's not that we're talking about base needs versus higher needs. We're talking about even here, base needs versus base needs, but that are different in kind.
Okay, good. This is great. So it'd be the distinction that I make between like healthy self-esteem versus unhealthy self-esteem. Unhealthy self-esteem being narcissism and healthy self-esteem being a sense of self-worth and competence. So yes.
Self-esteem is actually anti-narcissistic, right? Mm-hmm. It has...
Correct.
In order to truly be healthy, it's acutely aware of all the things that it's not good at, And it doesn't have its sense of self-worth or lovability coupled to that. So it doesn't have to be in competition with everyone all the time. It wants to see a healthy world. So it wants to see other people succeeding, right? Its own success doesn't get made less by other people's success. So healthy self-esteem and narcissism aren't like slightly similar versions. They're almost antithetical in really deep ways to each other, right?
They are. But yes, and by healthy and unhealthy, I mean in terms of they're both attempts to regulate that need for self-esteem.
Correct.
But one does it in a very unhealthy, detrimental way that's not leading to growth. And one way is actually caring about growth, even at the expense of an ego being hurt or something along those lines. Yeah.
Okay, so how we define the healthy versus unhealthy is super important. I want to drop back down below esteem to survival again and go back to the fast food example, because it's a particularly clear one, and then we can go all the way up. So in an evolutionary environment for humans, there wasn't a lot of abundant sugar floating around. You could get a few fruits and a few times a year, not that many. Fruit trees weren't like they are now that they've been hybridized. And there was so much kind of caloric surplus in the fruit in the place where famine was a real thing and most people died from famine, that there was a dopaminergic response associated with sugar and the sweet taste, because those who got more of it survived better, right? Mm. And the same is true with fat, and the same is true with salt. Those were all hard things in evolutionary environment to get. So given that they were scarce and they were evolutionarily adaptive, we have a strong feels good, do it again response, right? A reward circuit associated with salt, fat, and sugar. Industrialization came along. We were able to extract salt and fat and sugar from the micronutrients that they were a part of, make abundant amounts of them, and then recombine salt, fat, sugar in lots of different ways, as a frappuccino, as a milkshake, as french fries. It's all just salt, fat, sugar with different types of flavor and palatability to maximize the dopaminergic response. So then we have starvation being a leading cause of death, obesity being one of the leading causes of death and obesity-related issues in the West, in the developed world. And so what we can see that we did is we extracted the reward part from what it was supposed to be coupled to. It was supposed to be coupled to vitamins and protein and minerals and the micronutrients and scarcity of resource, so having some abundance where it was actually needed. Now we have excessive amounts, but the reward circuit hasn't evolutionarily changed, right? So it's a fucked up reward circuit. And what I would say fast food is to real nutrition, where you decoupled the reward from what it should be rewarding, decoupled it from an actual evolutionary benefit. That's what porn is to sexuality. It's what social media is to real social relationships. It's what online shopping is relative to evolutionary impulse to explore and find relevant new things, novelty searching.
I would push back on one of the things you said for the sake of conversation.
Please.
I think that social media can form real social relationships. I think there's a certain it that doesn't tend to, and we see a lot of unhealthy aspects of it. But I think, you know, a lot of people who have difficulty communicating with each other outside of online have found really strong communities, like people in the autism community, for instance, and things that have formed real deep relationships. So I would make the case that analogy is not 100% correct, because you know social media can afford real social relationships, but it just doesn't tend to be the case.
Well, okay. So it's a great example. Autism community being an actual community online, because even without leaving their house and going into social environments that are awkward, they can find people and talk to them. So there's this issue of way too many men in China because of the one child policy for a long time, and it's selected for men. And so you have a bunch of unmarriable men, something like maybe 100 million of them. And that's a pretty big deal, because whenever a society gets too many men, if the men can't get laid, they decide to blow the society up. And so you have to usually start a land war to get rid of some of the men and usually advance the aims of the society. Like, that's kind of a well-known phenomena. And so, but in modern time, what do we do with it? So one of the things that has been happening is a lot of these men falling in love with an AI chatbot. And you can imagine a world where VR porn with AI chatbot type features deals with issues like that. And you're like, hey, porn did a good thing. It's not that it can't ever do a good thing. It's that overall, it is oriented in a way that has reward circuits that are decoupled from the thing they evolved to enhance. Right. Overarchingly, that's the phenomena we're looking at, is that someone is getting a reward process for something that is not net healthy or evolutionary for them or their role in society. And so I would say at every level of Maslow's hierarchy, there are going to be places where I can get a reward circuit that makes me keep doing the thing, but that the thing that I'm doing is not net developmental and a meaningful definition of development versus making sure that my reward circuit is actually coupled to real development.
So an interesting thing about the Maslow hierarchy in my revised hierarchy is that I don't actually treat as levels, but as different, forms of integration. So that's why I changed it from like a hierarchical triangle to a pyramid to a sailboat, an integrated whole unit. And I know we've had some real, I remember having a conversation with, I don't know, do you remember like we had a conversation in your car? Your car once after a long walk, and we talked about integration in Encinitas. Do you remember this? So there are two things that we both of us have been super interested in since we've known each other: integration and emergence. And I'm wondering how they come into play here, right? Because to me, it seems like healthy use of social media is a possibility, but it actually takes a lot more integration than a lot of people have the patience to, you know, it's a lot quicker to have this kind of disintegration on social media, and you see it disintegrates quickly. So anyway, I just wanted to riff on that and get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's actually very interesting, because so you say it disintegrates quickly. And one of the classic examples that we see is the amount of polarization that occurs in social media, whether we're talking about social justice or vaccines or climate change or gay marriage or whatever. And so this is an example of where the technology is being developed in a landscape where the economics shaped it so heavily, right? They didn't want to charge the users, so the users aren't the customers, the advertisers are. So selling the user behavior is the product. And so gathering behavior on the user, gathering behavioral data on them to be able to sell it, and that should actually be a breach of fiduciary law, except it doesn't apply because when it was developed, this type of thing didn't exist. Because Facebook is gathering an amount of information on you from a predictive behavioral analytic point of view that should be considered privileged information. They can predict your behavior in consequential ways more than your psychotherapist or your lawyer or whoever else could that has a fiduciary responsibility to only use that information in your interest. But here they're selling it to other people, political actors and corporate actors that want you to do a behavior that's aligned with their interests. There's a real problem with that, but you can see that like if Facebook simply charged you for a service and let you calibrate what it was optimizing for and had a fiduciary responsibility to you in order to have access to that much of your behavioral data, it would be totally different. But because they're selling ads, they want to maximize your time on site and your engagement. And it happens to be that the things that are more addictive maximize time on site, and the things that are more polarizing maximize engagement. So when you train the AI on maximize time on site and maximize engagement, and it's just running personal analytics at a scale nobody could possibly make sense of, the most polarizing shit and the most limbically hijacking shit is what emerges. And the lower angels of our nature, again, meaning it's easier to get the dopamine hit from the fast food than it is to get the better feelings from the eating salad and veggies and exercising, which is going to take me months to feel better that like, oh, wow, I actually have less inflammation in my body and I can move and I feel better about things. There's a two marshmallow delayed gratification thing. And so it's the broken reward circuits are just faster. You can appeal to them easier. So capitalism appeals to the lower angels of our nature better than the higher angels of our nature, right? Because the higher angels of our nature don't need to buy an extrinsic thing to get happiness, and they don't make immediate actions as quickly based on some kind of impulsivity. So the marketing is going to appeal to impulse control disorders and pushing pain points to then offer market-based solutions.
Yeah.
And then being able to AI optimize this ad over this ad from this company over this company just creates an arms race of maximizing addictiveness writ large everywhere.
Well, you nailed it. That is what's happening. You know, the psychological concept, time preference, seems relevant here. And it's just very interesting because all the things we know about, you know, in the self-control literature, the self-development literature, all the things we know that if we want to have long-term goals and strategies we use to curb those long-term goals, I mean, social media, they're not designing things to bring out the best long-term in people. It's but they could. The point that I think the point is, and this is where we're getting this, is we
need a different business model.
Yeah, yeah. And so I really want to have that conversation with you too. What could this new business model look? What is positive product design? As my colleague Courtney Bigoni is doing great work along those lines, and as you are and your colleagues, what would the new algorithm look like?
I believe the colleague that introduced us was Zach Stein, and
That's right.
Some of the early work he did was work on development, like following the Piaget kind of work of stages of childhood development past 18 as an assumption that that's when humans stop meaningfully developing, and continuing to ask, what does a developed human being in a meaningful sense ongoingly? How do we assess that? How do we create education for it? How do we personalize education for it? And so the group Lectica built this thing called Lectical Score. One of the things that they were looking at, they're like, this is a good characteristic of development writ large, is someone's orientation to seek multiple perspectives, right? In a complex scenario, recognize that each perspective will have some signal, not be pure noise. But every perspective will probably have some noise in it. So let me seek as many perspectives as possible. The first part is perspective seeking and perspective taking. Next part would be the ability to parse those perspectives to try to find the signal and get rid of the noise, and then do synthesis. And so the complexity to be able to take many perspectives, to parse them, to bring them together, and to yet still hold enough uncertainty to continue to evolve that would be a thing we would like to develop in people, right? So let's say we could automate a lectical assessment of people based on their online behavior. And let's say that we train Facebook's algorithm to increase people's lectical score. So it was going to put in front of them, and let's make it simpler. We want to increase people's attention span rather than decrease it. And we want to increase their non-dopaminergic attention. So we don't just increase their attention span by giving them like only more animated videos that they can make it through longer, but like increase their attention span with text, right? With some boring shit, which means, and it's actually really important why, right? It's important that if there is to be any volition or self-determination of the being, that they're able to engage their attention in a self-directed way for enough time to be able to actually get enough information to process the complexity of a thing. So let's say that Facebook said, all right, we want to increase everyone's attention span. We want to increase their intentionality rather than their distraction. So we're going to do continual check-ins on the nature of their intentionality. I have some friends that just sent me a thing on that they're working on developing some technology to do attention and intention upregulation.
I love it.
You know, you can see a lot of things that we could assess that we would add to the objective function that we wanted to optimize for that would be net positive. And I don't have to say, hey, because everyone would have a concern. Well, is the right going to have a control on this? Or is the left going to have a control on this? If you're perspective seeking, then it doesn't fucking matter. We're not trying to make people have one view more. We're trying to make people better at seeking the range of views, being able to understand them, being able to articulate them in more nuanced ways.
This is the tricky thing, because the lower angel, the most immediate short-term response, is the one that's partisan, is the one that's tied to your own identity.
Yeah.
So I'm just pointing this out to our audience.
Yeah, that's a kind of McDonald's. It's a kind of heroin. It's a kind of porn, right? Tribal identity in politics is to real political thinking what porn is to real intimate relationships.
Well, I'll speak for yourself. No, I'm joking.
So what I mean is, it's a way to get the dopaminergic hit of certainty and sanctimony and righteousness and group identity without possibly advancing a functional thing. Think about this. So many people in the U.S., whether our issue is social justice or our issue is vaccines, our greatest enemy is our fellow countrymen, right? The right's antipathy of the left, the left's antipathy of the right is so intense that our fellow countrymen are our greatest enemies. We put most of our energy into infighting there. Well, what happens to that nation? That nation breaks down pretty fucking fast. Well, China's Belt and Road Initiative becomes the new 21st century global power structure because they don't create a system of internal antipathy. And if we put all this energy into political infighting every 4 years to get someone elected who will not be able to focus on anything that will take 4 years or longer, and all infrastructure and everything takes 4 years or longer. So they'll only be able to focus on super short-term shit, and whatever they do will get undone in the next 4 years. And whatever new technology of being able to engage the people and get them out to vote or change their minds that we figure out how to use, the other side, if we're effective, will reverse engineer it and make a better version. So we just drive arms races on that. That's just a path to self-termination. You cannot possibly run a democracy effectively where your fellow countrymen are your enemy, and where your all of the energy turns into waste heat because of infighting. So all that does is select out democracy and have technologically empowered authoritarianism guaranteed to rule the world. And so if you are busy doing left-right infighting, you're also just busy killing open societies completely and voting for digital or technologically empowered autocracy running the world. Your little issue that you're focused on is a much littler fucking issue than, do we have a process to address issues at all that is aligned with the kind of society we would like to have?
That's exactly what we're talking about right now. So how can the default response be perspective taking? That's my question.
Oh, this is how we come to the one marshmallow versus two marshmallow thing. Yay. In politics is there is a dopaminergic hit on certainty. Because think about it, in an evolutionary environment, right? In a tribal type environment, having clarity, certainty to know how to act had value. Are there dangerous predators over there? Is there a tribe that we're going to have to deal with? Is there food to go pursue? Like, there's value in the certainty. And it was fairly straightforward to get it for those types of things, because you just go look and you could poke it with a stick and have direct 5 cents experience of the thing, and someone else could come have 5 cents experience of the same thing, right? But now almost all the things we're certain of, nobody can poke with a stick. Nobody's seen. Nobody really has a sense what the CCP is doing or what happened in Wuhan Virology Institute or if the mRNA really such and such, or if no fucking idea, but totally certain.
No right? idea. What everyone thinks they're certain they know, though.
Yeah. And so there's it feels good to be certain. Mm. There's a certain good feeling of righteousness and kind of moral sanctimony. Mm. And there's a certain good feeling of feeling like I'm with the other ones who are right. Mm. But all of that is the good feeling of eating McDonald's. Mm. Right? It's a dopaminergic hit that is artificially giving a neurotransmitter to your brain that is decoupled from the actual thing that neurotransmitter would have evolutionarily signaled for. And so it feels good, but is actually making you dumber and badder while you're thinking that you are smarter and gooder, right? Thinking that you are more doing the true and good thing.
Yeah. If we would get really nerdy here, there are multiple dopamine pathways. And I've written articles about more evolved dopamine pathways that send projections to the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is what we want to engage more when we're talking about your kind of way of perspective taking and holding consciousness and being able to inhibit the prepotent response. That's all executive functions, which do have dopamine projections, but they're more later evolved. So they're not as default. Default. I don't know why I said it like that. They're not as default. But I've written about that. I've called it the nerdy dopamine pathway is what I've called it. So we need to activate more of the nerdy dopamine pathway. I think you would agree.
Yeah. Okay. So this is very interesting. You come back to polarization and we come back to the topic of democracy for a moment. So modern democracies emerged following the printing press, because the printing press meant textbooks and newspaper for everyone. So you don't need a privileged nobility class that has access to education and information. Everybody can get educated and everybody can know what's going on so that they can all participate in government. Mm-hmm. The social media is really an anti-fourth estate, and the exact opposite of a printing press, because rather than everyone being able to get a newspaper to have the same information about base reality to then make decisions on, here we're going to customize a news feed to my preferences. So two people will have certainty because there's an ubiquity of information that was customized to my likelihood to believe it and interact with it, but they're seeing completely different worlds. Mm. And yet that makes me engage more, seeing the things that hit my preference biases. And so you have AI more powerful than the AI that beat Kasparov at chess, optimizing everyone towards doubling down on their own biases, group identities, limbic hijacks, and bias for certainty. So democracy breaks with that. You get an increasingly polarized population, which creates an increasingly polarized representative class, which has more and more gridlock, which can't get shit done, which just loses to authoritarianism. And especially technologically empowered authoritarianism that without the gridlock inside can implement exponential tech towards long-term visions. So when we come back to the printing press thing, it's not just that democracy emerged when we had broadcast and the ability to get the same message out to everyone. It's that reading was actually an important part of it. This was something that Marshall McLuhan discussed, and the guys at the Digital Life Foundation go into quite a lot, is at the time of, say, the development of this country and a lot of the political thinking associated, there's very little hypernormal stimuli in reading plain text on paper. And you have to actually stay focused for a fairly long period of time without distractions to get the content in. So you're actually training attention span like a muscle. And obviously, to engage in democracy, I've got to be able to hold my view and someone else's view and someone else's view at the same time, right? The complexity of the situation means I need more working memory to hold the whole thing. If my working memory and attention span comes too small, I can only be a fundamentalist who has reactionary views that can fit into sound bites.
Correct.
Because the truth is too nuanced to fit into a soundbite. So you have to have much longer attention spans, which means you have to train attention span, which means rather than fast cycles of low dopaminergic stuff, I need stuff like reading. It's boring as fuck. And then also writing, right? When the medium was reading and writing, writing also meant I had to be able to understand what I thought well enough to articulate it in structured form. And so I'm not saying we go to a pre-digital age. We're not going to, but we have to look at the things, the cognitive capacities that those media were developing in us, and say, in this new media age, how do we develop those same cognitive capacities? And if not, what does that portend for our social structures?
Yes, and you'll play improv here with you. Yes, and the dopamine pathway that goes to the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex is correlated with the personality trait openness to experience. So there are individual differences in this, and there are some people who do find greater reward value of information, of learning new information. So, you know, knowing that, how can we kind of, for those that are very low on that personality trait spectrum, where they're not getting reward value from information, they're getting more reward value from more of the primal dopamine pathways, sex, drugs, rock and roll, you know, how do we kind of increase that motivation in everyone? Because that's, I mean, that's obviously the million-dollar question.
First thing is that you can be aware of what increases the opposite of it in people and start looking at how do we deal with that. We can't have multi-billion person networks with multi-trillion dollar market caps using AI and personalization to make people oriented to certainty even more aggressively, angrily, righteously certain, right? Like if you're doing that thing, you're not just saying, how do we, it's not just, can we develop everyone more? It's, look, we're actually fucking the thing up pretty badly. So that's one thing to look at. The other thing is like, okay, are those differences genetic? Are they early childhood? Are they even in utero? What was going on in the neurochemistry of the mom that was affecting the receptor site formations? Who the fuck knows? I think it's very complex, and every piece of science looks at the thing it's looking at and then over-indexes how important that thing was. But I think it's a complex function of a lot of those things. But you look at across cultures where you have you're going to have a distribution of different genetic predispositions and typologies, yet where you still get the bell curve moved one way or the other for the culture as a whole, which is indicating the way enculturation works. And so you look at Buddhists and their orientation regarding violence across age groups and whatever, and you're like, are the Buddhists less violent historically across the last 3,000 years, 10 million people varying plus or minus wartime, peacetime, famine, whatever? Yes, they're just less violent. Can you attribute that to genes? No, it's lots of different gene groups. And some people with the same genes who are not Buddhists but are Hindus or Muslims or whatever else are more violent in other situations. Like enculturing people to compassion for all sentient beings as the core thing from early childhood with all of the practices, like it actually works. If you look at Jews and you're like, do Jews develop a higher degree of education across the bell curve for their people, regardless of the embedding environment they're in? They do. They do a pretty good job of that historically across a couple thousand years at least. And so there's something in the culture of what the value systems are and how they embed the value systems that have to do with the nature. You know, does the Sabbath have something to do with making sure that tech isn't running your life too much because you have a break from its effect on your life, where you're also communing with the sacred and the sense of what, how should my life be directed? You know, like that itself would be a social technology that's very interesting to be able to bind a culture and increase its power to steward physical technology well. So can we develop everyone? Can we prevent people from being developed in the worst ways? Yes. Can we develop people in progressively better ways as whole cultures, independent of individual disposition? Yes. Should everyone be equally good at all things? No, because the person who might have less reward circuit on complex cognitive abstract thought might be a fucking brilliant musician. And so great. Society wants lots of different kinds of things, right?
Yes.
Insofar as it starts to have to do with governance, now we have this big question. This is why, do we want a direct democracy where everyone votes on everything, or where they just vote on representatives? A lot of the arguments against direct democracy were like, fuck, do you really want these people voting on everything? Or do you at least want them to vote on a representative class that has some training in law and politics and stuff to not do super dumb stuff? We can do better than that now. We can do things like a liquid democracy, where rather than pick one representative to represent me across all things, who now, like, okay, so this person is supposed to have a say on defense issues and technology issues and monetary issues and international policy and domestic, like, what the fuck? Who has that expertise? So what if we have a liquid democracy situation where we have, say, a digital democratic platform? I get to engage in the topics. And on the topics where I don't understand them well, I can cede my vote to someone who does, that I think understands it well in that topic. But the guy who I really trust in what we should do with the energy grid might be totally different than who I trust in what I think we should do with monetary policy. Now, what if we can go a step further and do something like qualified platforms where you bind rights and responsibilities? This starts to sound really tricky, but when you think about what all the alternatives are, what's scary about this is not more scary. It's less scary than what's scarier about all the other options. So binding rights and responsibilities.
Do you mean integrate them? What do you mean by binding?
If I have a right without an attendant responsibility, we end up getting entitlement dynamics.
Yeah.
If I have a responsibility without a right, we get enslavement dynamics. And so the binding of, if I want more rights in the system, there are more responsibilities. Because if I have the right to influence the system in a certain way, but somebody's going to be responsible to implement that shit, but I don't have any responsibility in it, I'll always vote myself benefits that I don't want to take responsibility for paying the cost of, right?
Yeah.
So there's something around the more responsibility we can take, the more right we have to influence a thing. It's a meritocratic kind of idea. There's, of course, problems with it. We could get into this in a more nuanced time where we have more nuance for it, but let's just imagine for a moment that we had a digital engagement kind of democratic platform, like where I could help craft individual propositions. So I didn't just have to vote yes or no in a bundled proposition where both suck, yes sucks and no sucks, based on what's bundled into it. And where the structure of that forces the polarization of the population just based on even those who are voting yes are causing harm to the people who are connected to whatever it harms them. Blah, blah, blah. So we can actually do proposition creation in this process. But let's say there's a thing where if I want to engage in this topic, there's a very basic test that I take that shows that I understand this kind of general pros and cons of the proposition or basic facts of the issue. It doesn't mean I have to agree with them. It just means that I understand some basic things and then I get engaged. If I don't, I still have a vote that I can proxy to someone who has through a liquid democracy. But rather than vote for a representative across the board, it can be someone who I think is good on that topic, but I can also choose to get more educated about that topic, and the platform will educate me in audio or video or text, if I'm blind or whatever, and in any language I want, and it's free, right? So I have the capacity to get more educated, but should everyone who has no idea at all really have a say in what our energy grid stability policy against EMPs and Carrington events be? Like, I don't want that. I want people who understand, who at least have some sense of understanding the basic things, so they weren't controlled by a manipulative populism, to engage in it. And if someone else that they know does have that basic understanding and they want to liquidly put it across, great. So now you have this issue where someone is like, fuck, I want to make great music. I trust these people in these areas. I don't care to know that much, but I'm also, now you don't have the populist incentive to have a demagogue leader try to get all of those people to believe nonsense so that they can go vote in a particular nonsense direction.
I mean, look, I agree with this theory, but I want to keep going back to, well, what? How can these big tech companies use this information to help redesign civilization?
Well, what we're talking about right now would be more something like, how could the governments of the world build the next phase of government, where we actually had to build a lot of infrastructure for this government, town halls where the people could meet and talk through the thing, and courts where the judiciary process could happen, and a mail system so the information could be shipped around. It's just, that's a super old system. It is not technologically relevant. And so now we have like e-services, so you can log on to DMV and do some basic shit, but the structure of government, how it processes information, has not evolved to process the kind of information issues that we have in a way that it could. Taiwan is the best example so far of a open society or a democratic country actually building a democratic platform where people can engage in fundamentally different ways than the previous system, because you couldn't fit everyone in a town hall. There was no way, but you could fit everyone into an internet platform that could contribute to, in constructive ways, to the creation of the right propositions. And they're doing a brilliant job with that. We wrote a paper overviewing the way Taiwan transitioned to digital democracy on the Consilience Project, if people want to check it out. Audrey Tang helped lead that work. And it's kind of important to realize that the nuclear bomb as a massive advancement in tech, the first existential tech ever, was not created by the market. It was created by the state. And the recognition that there was an existential risk if it didn't create it, it created an indefinite budget, right? Black budget, to bring all the top scientists together to build the tech that the world, that the country needed. We could do a Manhattan Project to take the AI and blockchain and all of the types of digital technology to build the next phase of open society, recognizing that open societies are being eroded and are almost totally gone. And they're being eroded by the same tech, because the tech is making corporations exponentially more powerful that are actually eroding democracy in the way that we have mentioned, and are unable to be regulated by the democracy because they're getting more powerful than it. And authoritarian nation states can implement the technology to make more powerful authoritarian nation states if open societies don't innovate in how to use that tech. Because the thing we said at the beginning is only the groups that are developing and deploying the exponential tech will have a say in the future, because that's where the power is. And yet none of the groups that are doing that are democratic or even have a democratic ideal. There's, whether it's a tech company or in a authoritarian nation state, they're top-down systems. So there is no bottom-up jurisprudence. And so I want to see open societies take on the role of innovating not one type of tech, but the whole suite of digital tech to make better open societies, because I don't see that open societies survive otherwise.
Okay, so let's talk about the Consilience Project a little bit. So how are you doing that? Now, you also are partnering with Tristan Harris on some stuff, right, from the Social Dilemma movie he was featured in there. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, The Social Dilemma, probably many people have seen it. If they haven't, it's worth checking out. And it just overviews a lot of the issues and harms that the attention economy technologies create. It's, Tristan's a lead in that, runs a group called the Center for Humane Technology. And so, yeah, we're good friends and colleagues, and worked with, talking with a lot of people in the U.S. government and other governments on how to address some of these issues, and some with tech companies, and some with just general public education. The Consilience Project is trying to put out content that will help people understand the deeper issues addressing the state of the world, so that they can more competently make sense of what is going on beyond what they would get through their newsfeed or other sources, so that also they can, the kind of collective intelligence of the world can be better applied to innovate the things that matter. We are about to do a series of 10 new papers that just centrally describe what we would consider the meta crisis, climate change and the issues associated with AI risk and tech and all the planetary boundary issues. Like, that they're actually all instantiations of a kind of broken civilization system. How do you understand what's wrong with the civilization system and what is needed to be stewards of the power of exponential tech? Kind of mythopoetically, you can say exponential tech is really powerful. It's like the power of gods, at least little gods, but we don't have the kind of wisdom, love, and prudence to use that power well. And you don't get to keep doing exponential warfare and exponential externalities on a finite planet, not blow yourself up. So what do we need in terms of a culture that is producing the love and wisdom and the new social systems made by that culture that have the ability to utilize the tech, but also bind, guide, and direct it to fully healthy for the people and the planet directions, not the extractive harm-causing ones. So we're writing that series and then other things to try and work on having more people understand a bigger picture of what's going on so that there are more people capable of problem solving in meaningful ways.
Well, I hope this podcast chat goes along those lines. Okay. You're not against exponential technologies. You're against increasingly decentralized exponential technologies.
Not about decentralized. Honestly, what you see with Facebook is a radical centralization of power, right? You have one social media company that is radically more powerful than all the other ones and really has a monopoly of attention. Facebook, I mean, Google is that to search engines. Amazon is that to online stores. There's a way that network dynamics started creating natural monopolies that weren't governed by previous antitrust type dynamics. And that's actually an example of how exponential tech leads to centralization in very harmful ways. But in other ways, decentralized exponential technologies are just as bad. So exponential tech both radically centralizes and decentralizes power, both in problematic ways. The decentralized power is the ability for a small group of people to do cyber attacks on infrastructure that can actually shut whole infrastructure down. The ability to, over the next little while, be able to build drone weapons and AI weapons and bioweapons by tiny little non-state actors that have catastrophic ability, right? The decentralization of radical power equals the decentralization of catastrophic power too. So how do you deal with a world where, like, we only had one catastrophe weapon when we had the bomb, but it was really hard to make, so it was pretty easy to control and monitor. But now we're talking about things that are not hard to make. They're super, super easy to make, but super catastrophic. So the decentralization of exponential tech gives a world of increasing catastrophes. The centralization of it gives dystopias. Right now, those are the only two attractors. I got catastrophes or dystopias.
I don't like any of those options.
Right. So we need a third attractor that has the power to bind the tech to not be catastrophic, but is not a top-down hegemon in the way that it binds it, which would be dystopic, which means how do you actually facilitate a collective intelligence, right? Something that is truly democratic, but that has the speed and effectiveness, which means it can't have polarization, it can't have tribalism, it can't have any of those dynamics, which is why it will probably fail. And which is why there's culture work that has to happen first and like pretty fucking significant culture work. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the dystopias, but that at least have top-down control win. And so this is why I really am caring about this. How do we upgrade people's cultural orientation to be like, okay, fuck, let me really seek to understand the other perspectives that I have currently just made the enemy, and let me avoid the dopamine hits of certainty and righteousness that my perspective is already right. Because without that, there is really no chance at all. Like, if you don't start to have a cultural movement that can instantiate new types of institutions that are of, for, and by a people that would instantiate those better institutions, then you either don't get the power to bind the tech, in which case the decentralized versions of the tech that emerge anywhere will just cause catastrophes. Or you end up getting someone who has the power to do it, but is not of, for, and by the people because the people can't agree with each other, in which case you get AI-empowered authoritarianism. And so, like, it's either AI-empowered authoritarianism, decentralized catastrophes, or a radical fucking cultural enlightenment to be able to have a government of, for, and by the people that has the capacities, because we've also developed the people in order to do that.
Yeah, you've called that the new enlightenment, right?
Something like that.
Yeah, something like that. The term changes sometimes. So, well, how can we create a world that is more anti-fragile considering these factors?
When you think about what creates fragility, you and I are talking on computers and microphones and all that, where the actual production of these computers took supply chains that probably span six continents. Right? In dozens of countries. So something can break in a local area where they're the only place that has the mind for that thing or the ability to do that kind of lithography or whatever it is, and you get cascades of breakdown. And we saw that in Wuhan, right? One area has an issue, and then you have to have travel lockdowns, which means you can't move fertilizers across borders, which means that you lose crop supply in Northern Africa and parts of the Middle East that affect hundreds of millions of people. And you're like, oh, fuck, that's very fragile. So increasing more local closed loop dynamics addresses fragility. Increasing stores of critical resource in terms of stocks and flows. But there's a trade-off between resiliency and efficiency. And we've indexed for efficiency so much because of money on money dynamics that indexing for efficiency means I don't want any stores, but that means much less resilient. So there's a lot of things that we can do infrastructurally and whatever for anti-fragility, but there's nothing as significant as having a collective intelligence that actually thinks about the world better and can, one, problem solve better, and problem solve with the other people, which means cooperate and coordinate, like sense make and choice make collectively better. And even more fundamentally, don't make the problem worse by getting inducted as warriors in somebody's kind of narrative war or information war. So the cultural shifts that we're talking about, where people actually seek many perspectives. Yep, that's a good one. They seek many perspectives. They seek to kind of empirically validate stuff. They seek to synthesize them. They seek to have real, meaningful, generative dialogue, realizing that the other people that you hate are still political actors and they don't leave the planet just when you win. They do shit, right? And so you have to coordinate with them or war with them. There is nothing we can do for resilience and anti-fragility better than increasing the collective intelligence of the people.
Okay, I want to double click on this idea of collective intelligence of the people. So can you explain a little bit more what you mean by a collective intelligence for our listeners?
Yeah, when we say collective intelligence, we're talking about the intelligence of the people plus the ways that groups of people can be more intelligent than just the sums of the individual people. So how do we make institutions and groups that are intelligent, which has to do with things like their ability to communicate and coordinate well? Obviously, the reason we will have like a scientific institution is because some things are too complicated for a person to figure out. So it takes a lot of people dividing up the work, working together well, but they have to be able to trust each other that they're not lying and whatever. They have to trust, check each other's work. They have to make sure their ego dynamics to take the credit don't get in the way too much that it kind of messes the stuff up. And if you have a bunch of really smart people and not a good system for them working together, the collective intelligence of the group will still be low, even though the intelligence of all the individual actors might be high. I have sadly been in many groups like that.
Me too.
And so democracy and markets are supposedly collective intelligence systems, right? How do we have the intelligence of everyone work together to have the best things emerge, the best choices made? They've broken down in really significant ways and they need really significant updates. And like the best thinking at the time of Adam Smith or the founding fathers is not the best thinking anymore. Even though the spirit of some of those principles, you know, needs to continue. So when I'm talking about collective intelligence, I'm talking about the world's ability to make sense of itself and make choices that everyone can contribute to and agree with, that if they're going to be affected by it or bound by it.
We are living in an age where there's this weaponization of complexity and intellect, and it has led to anti-intellectualism and, I would say, distrust of science as a counterweapon. And so I'm just wondering what you think we can do about that.
Yeah, we have a paper in the Consensus Project on the challenges of 21st century sense-making that's worth checking out. And one of the things that is discussed is how many of the things that this, I think this came out of the work of Ulrich Beck after during the Cold War, and specifically looking at nuclear risk, that uranium isotope in the air after Chernobyl blows up or whatever is invisible. And whether it is a democratic government or an autocratic government trying to figure out, well, how far did the wind blow that stuff to, and what parts per million should we allow to say, where do we tell all the farmers they have to till their stuff back into the soil versus we can feed it to people? If you don't have a Geiger counter, you're going to have a real hard time just kind of rule of thumb in that one, you know? And so there were a lot of people who were like, before the tech advanced very rapidly and the world changed much slower, you could just kind of have a sense of like the way we've done things for a long time is the right way to do things. We can trust the knowledge of our forefathers. We always done it this way. Yeah, but you didn't fucking have nuclear isotopes. That's a new thing. And your hunch for what happens with them is just gibberish. It's based on nothing, right? So we need Geiger counters to check it out. We need to do some studies on what parts per million really seem to have big effects. But that means that there is some privileged class of people that know how to read a Geiger counter and know how to do cell cultures that we have to trust to some new kind of priesthood to tell us what the invisible but significant shit means. And so how do we know if we can trust them? Because it is kind of, it's invisible stuff. And this is COVID again, right? Like it's or like, okay, we don't want certain kinds of petrotoxins, pesticides, whatever in our food. Well, when invisible stuff, and this is climate change again, has real causal implications, so you can't sense it yourself, you have to basically empower some group that has the capacity to sense it. And then the question is, how do you do checks and balances on that? How do you create an institution that has institutional capacity that the people actually trust?
That's right.
And it's, you know, it's a tricky thing. But as we have a continuously technologically complex world, we'll have more and more invisible stuff and more hyper object and complex stuff and more places where what affects one thing affects lots and lots of other things. And all that complexity has to be factored. And so now think about it like this. Okay, we want a democratic population who get to have a say in things, but they want to have a say in things like the application of tech that they absolutely don't have the education to create that tech, right? It was a whole bunch of PhD engineers from MIT and whatever that created the tech. And they know they couldn't create the fucking tech, but they want access to the tech. And then they want to make sure that there isn't some governing body that is governing it in a way that will affect their convenience or their economy or whatever it is. It's like, wait, if you can't understand how to make the tech, you probably can't be involved in its governance. Now, that doesn't mean can't be involved at all. You can say what your values are. You can say what you care about.
You can still tweet your opinion about it.
Well, no, that's actually the problem, right? Is I can tweet an opinion that is based on gibberish.
Yeah, I was saying that ironically.
I know.
Yeah, okay.
But in terms of the actual systems we want to develop, the ability to regulate a thing well and the ability to understand it well are coupled. And this is that rights and responsibilities thing. If I want to have the right to really influence a thing, there's a responsibility to understand it well enough that I actually know what I'm talking about.
Oh, I agree. I mean, you just see how many people on the internet think they're experts on the science of intelligence. And it makes my head want to explode. Yeah. So that just to take my own field, for example. So are most of these issues that we're talking about, existential threats, are they historically novel? How do you see that in terms of the whole arc of humanity?
Yeah, very hard for a caveman to blow up the world. Very hard for Caesar to blow up the world.
Fair enough.
Right? It's a technologically mediated thing. And as our technology got bigger, our civilizations got bigger because we had technology that could extract resources and defend itself and whatever more effectively. But what that also means is we had technology that could destroy ecosystems and win in war against other groups. And so if I'm chopping trees down, like the world's pretty big, if I'm chopping trees down with axes, it does seem like trees are inexhaustible. So we just price the tree at the cost to extract it. I don't look at what it took nature to make it. I don't look at the effects on the ecosystem of what it's doing to stabilize topsoil and watersheds and oxygen and CO2 and all of that stuff. It's just because there's still plenty of trees, but I take this thing and make lumber out of it. And so it's really just called taking the shit from nature's being industrious. And there is no balance sheet of nature that has to be paid or accounted for or whatever. But when the tech gets bigger, right, and we start to get into slash and burn of whole massive areas of forest to get the resources under them, and we go from a fishing pole to mile-long drift nets, and we go from 500 million people before the Industrial Revolution to 8 billion people empowered by those types of radical industrial and the nuclear age and digital age technologies, the power of our tech has gone up so radically that the power of our both intentional and unintentional destructive capacity has gone up, right? And the constructive capacity also, but if the constructive capacity is not for everyone, it's probably still has a destructive element that's associated with it, right?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And so we didn't have the ability to start doing things at a scale that could really harm the world beyond our local area until the Industrial Revolution. And the Industrial Revolution was like, okay, we can start to really scale some shit, which is why we went from 500 million people to 8 billion people in almost no period of time. Even though 300,000 years of Homo sapiens and we never broke a 500 million people. And then it wasn't until the bomb, World War II, that we had the ability to kill everything in a hurry. Right? That was a big deal. So we had to make this entire world system, the Bretton Woods UN mutually assured destruction world system, to make sure that we didn't use our new tech. And that was one catastrophe weapon. Now we have dozens of catastrophe weapons. It's a brand new situation. We have dozens of catastrophe weapons. And instead of having two actors that have them where you can do mutually assured destruction, we have an indefinite number of actors and you can't even know who has them. So you can't do mutually assured destruction. Part of the solution to World War II not turning into World War III and the post-World War II answer was, we don't want the major empires to war, even though for the history of the world, the major empires always warred. But now the weapons are so big that if they do, they fuck everything for everyone. So they have to not war, but everybody still wants more stuff. So we have to get them to get more stuff without taking each other's stuff. So we just have to make exponentially more stuff. So we're going to make a monetary system based on exponential growth. And that's going to drive an exponential growth in goods and services, but that also means an exponential growth in taking shit from nature faster than it can replenish and turning it into waste faster than it can be processed. So then you start to hit planetary boundaries on overfishing and cutting down all the trees and excessive extraction of all the resources and then turning it into climate change and pollution of a gazillion types over on this side, microplastics and dead zones and oceans. So the solution to how do we not war drove all the planetary fragility issues. And then the other thing was, the other way we won't war is we'll do this globalization thing where we get so globally interconnected that you don't want to bomb each other because then your supply chains are messed up. But that is what then creates the fragility dynamics we mentioned, where the world gets so complicated and so fragile that a little collapse anywhere can create cascading collapses everywhere. So basically, there was no global catastrophic risk, human-induced catastrophic risk, till World War II. We got our first one in World War II, and it was such a big deal, we built an entire world system to mediate it. It bought us like 75 years of no world war, but of course, lots of proxy war and economic war and info war and whatever. It created all these planetary boundary issues, created the fragility issues, and created the proliferation of tech across dozens of sectors where now we have lots of catastrophe weapons, right? Not just nukes, but AI weapons and bioweapons and blah, 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 cyber weapons. So now we're in the situation where we have to build a new world system again, like we did after World War II, but it's for a completely different risk landscape. And so it takes completely different characteristics. It won't be based on exponential growth of the monetary system. It won't be based on a system that drives more fragility. So it has to have interconnectedness without fragility. It won't just drive tech to drive markets of all kinds. It has to have anticipatory regulation because of the speed of the effect of tech built right into the process. So this is basically what the world, this is the challenge the world needs to rise to right now, as I see it.
Beautiful. Well, I'm really glad there are people like you who are thinking through these issues for civilization. Thank you so much for being my podcast today. Where can people, if they want to read your papers, you mentioned a couple papers that are coming out. Where can people read this stuff?
Yeah, they can go to consilienceproject.org and check it out.
And I've noticed you're not on Twitter. Is that intentional?
I'm not. Yeah, I've contemplated, but it hasn't been something I've needed to do yet.
There's someone called Daniel Schmachtenberger Says on Twitter. Did you know that? Did you know that?
I don't know who that is.
Yeah, I guess the closest I think can do to tag you when I tag you on Twitter. So sometimes I talk about some of your stuff. Look, Daniel, I really always get so much from chatting with you today, and I'm sure our listeners will as well. Thanks again for thinking about the future of civilization and for chatting with me today on the podcast.
This was a really fun talk. I enjoyed all the things we covered. Thank you, Scott.
Me too. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.